Good evening. Where I grew up, on a night like this, people would say to each other, "Hot enough for you?" Jennifer, it's lovely to see you. It's been a long time.
Yeah, I've been really busy, but my trip to Seattle went really well.
Good. And you're back. Very happy to see you. So we've started a new book, as you may know. It's called the Vimalakirti Sutra, Burton Watson translation. And we're just about to begin the second chapter. So you didn't miss much. Excuse me? Oh, thank you, Karen. So, as I promised last week, I copied the introduction to it's Thurman's book. Yeah, I'm trying to think what he calls it. But he's got a very nice introduction that is not required reading for anybody. But I thought if you were interested, it gives a very nice perspective and overall view that is very nice. This is it. Every teacher tries to describe in words what we just chanted. Form doesn't differ from emptiness, and emptiness does not differ from form. This is another version of that. And it's historical, and he tries to disabuse us of some notions that we might have around it, that it's not either or, this or that, it's both and. And he describes that pretty clearly. So the second chapter is very telling because, having established the Buddha lands, our friend Vimalakirti shows up and is the subject of this story. He was a rich man. He had every benefit in life, and he had every goodness in life. He really practiced hard, and he did his very best, and he was admirable in every way. And as a result, all the Buddhas admired him very much. So he wanted to share his whole understanding of life, his own deep way of being in the world without messing up so much. And his way of doing that was to crawl into bed and tell everybody he was sick. "Sorry, folks, I'm sick. You'll have to come and visit me if you want to see me." And so they came. It describes his character in terms of the paramitas. He was generous. He was did all the kindnesses to all, and he was vigorous and I'm not saying it very well. His immeasurable riches to relieve the poor, his faultless observation of the precepts served as a reproach to those who would violate prohibitions. He had restraint and forbearance. He warned others against rage and anger, and his great assiduousness discouraged all thought of sloth and indolence. Concerning his single mind in quiet meditation, he suppressed disordered thoughts, though through firm and unwavering wisdom he overcame all that was not wise. So it wasn't that he was perfectly wise, it's that he dealt with it. He was willing to deal with it. So he was dressed like a layman, and he acted like a layman. But he observed all the monkish rules at the same time. So he was chaste, he was proper, he was unattached, and yet he had a wife and children, and had a household and attendants, and yet he delighted in withdrawing from everyone. So he had a practice in the middle of his life. Interestingly, I was just sent a study that somebody did of ancient Indian Buddhist practices, in which he had delved deeply into descriptions of how monks actually lived and how nuns actually lived in ancient India at the time of Buddha. They were married. They had children. If they were pregnant, it was fine. It was a complete different picture from what we see of these completely austere and chaste and shut away people. They were not shut away. They were living just like Vimalakirti is described, eating and drinking with others, though what he truly savored was the joy of meditation. So I haven't read it yet, but I can't wait. I think it's really very interesting. We live in an era when so many things open up in this way. We think we know what the story is, and little by little, more and more information comes to us that clears it up, clears up the picture somewhat, and makes the practice itself more coherent and available to us. I mean, we always say, of course, it's for everybody, but it always looks like somebody in a long robe and walking around in a kind of austere way is kind of special, but no special than any one of us. All the same. So he frequented the busy crossroads in order to bring benefit to others. He visited places of debate in order to guide others to the great vehicle. He visited schools and study halls to instruct the pupils and entered houses of ill fame to teach the folly of fleshly desire, entered wine shops in order to encourage those with a will to quit them, or to show the unease associated with desire, is Thomas Cleary's translation. the unease associated with desire. That's interesting. It's so great. It's so uneasy. If he was among rich men, they honored him as foremost among them because he preached the law to them. And among lay believers, they honored him foremost because he freed them from greed and attachment. And among others, he taught them forbearance, and then he taught them all the paramitas all the way through again. Wisdom and forbearance and meditation. The common people honored him first among them because he helped them to gain wealth and power. And that reminds me of Chogyam Trungpa, who always told his students, go out and make money. Go out and wear fine clothes. Go out and show that the Dharma is good for people. Go out and have beautiful food to eat. Said, and share that with people, because that shows how wonderful the Dharma is. It's not for grubbing and being, you know, hiding and being modest. It's to truly take our place, our stand in the world, and find a way to express it with the joy. And of course it can be modest, because most of us are modest, kind of shy people, but it can be an expression of exactly who we are, rather than trying to modify it by being spiritual or precious in some way. We don't have to be precious. Just be our best self. You know, when we lift our hands, when we bow, it's lifting up Buddha, our best self, out of our own life and body. He used a lot of what they call expedient means, meaning he would do almost anything in order to persuade people. So he made it appear that his body had fallen prey to illness. That was his expedient means. Oh, I'm so sick. Oh, you'll have to come and see me. And because of his illness, the king of the country, the great ministers, rich men, lay believers, and Brahmins, as well as the princes and lesser officials, numbering countless thousands, all went to see him and inquire about his illness. So in this one little room, all these people appeared, all very concerned about him. So this is the miraculous side of the story. How can this be? He then used his illness to expound the law. Good people, the body is impermanent, without durability, without strength, without firmness, a thing that decays in a moment, not to be relied on. It suffers, it's tormented, a meeting place of manifold ills. That's a very important message. It's one we don't really want to know very much about. And when we're stricken with an obvious example of it in our own body, it's very upsetting. But it's the truth. And the truth, as they always say, makes us free. Free to be what this is. Good people, he said, no person of enlightened wisdom could depend on a thing like this body. This body is like a cluster of foam, nothing you can grasp or handle. This body is like a bubble that cannot continue for long. This body is like a flame born of longing and desire. This body is like the phantom that has no firmness in its trunk, the plantain. This body is like a phantom, the product of error and confusion. This body is like a dream, compounded of false and empty visions. It's like a shadow. It's like an echo. It's like a drifting cloud changing and vanishing in an instant. This body is like lightning, barely lasting from moment to moment. And he goes on for a whole nother paragraph. So he goes on, good people, a thing like this is irksome and hateful, and therefore you should seek the Buddha body. Why? Because the Buddha body is the Dharma body. It is born from immeasurable merits and wisdom. It is born from precepts, meditation, wisdom, emancipation, and the insight of emancipation. It is born from pity, compassion, joy, and indifference. It is born of the various paramitas, such as almsgiving, keeping of the precepts, forbearance and gentleness, assiduousness in religious practice, meditation, emancipation, and samadhi, wide knowledge and wisdom. It's the study of the realized. It is born of expedient means, born of the six transcendent powers, and of the three understandings, of the 37 elements of the way, born of concentration and insight, of the 10 powers, the 4 kinds of fearlessness, and the 18 unshared properties. I don't know quite what those are, but we could look them up if anybody is very interested. It is born of the coming off of all things not good and the gathering in of all good things. Born of the truth, born of the avoidance of indulgence and body of the thus come, laxity. The body of the thus come one is born of immeasurable numbers of pure and spotless things such as these. Good people, if you wish to gain the Buddha body and do away with the ills that affect all living things, then you must set your minds on attaining Anuttara Samyaksambodhi, or unexcelled perfect enlightenment. In this manner, the rich man Vimalakirti used the occasion to preach the law to those who came to inquire about his illness. As a result, numberless thousands of persons were all moved to set their minds on attainment of enlightenment. End of chapter. Jennifer?
So what happened when they realized he wasn't fatally ill?
Well, I have to read on to find out. You can read the end of the book if you want to, but it's so we have time for questions and discussion tonight. Charlene.
So you said that your best is just being your best self. What is your best self? I mean, I thought of it as like your best self is where you're not attached to anything. But then you're saying like these people have families that meant they were like attached to them, and like good clothes and good food. Aren't those attached to?
Attachment doesn't mean having stuff. It means not being willing to let them go when you have to. It's really different. And, of course, we have a problem with letting things go, especially when we make deep, deep connections with family. of course, it's very natural. And of course, therefore, we suffer greatly from our attachments. But having the insight to understand that is an enormous help. Seeing the truth of things rather than clinging to things and trying to make it different from what it is. It's such a human proclivity to want to make everything into our way and think it's got to be that way, even though things are shifting and changing all the time as our life. And so to allow the shifting and changing and to let things go when they have to go, sometimes it's really tough, as we all know. It's really, really hard. And we don't let things go with a sneer, or we let them go with our loving kindness, with our most powerful and deepest kindness, and give them our blessing as best we can. Life is poignant. Life is so sweet often, in spite of how difficult it is, how hard it is. It has this depth of sweetness and joy and kindness in it that is developed in our sitting and our relationship with others in terms of attachment. It's how we let them go and then finally let ourselves go. You know, eventually we have to kiss ourselves goodbye. Actually, you know, we can do that ahead of time if we are serious about practice. That when they talk about dropping the self, it's really dropping the attachment to the self and kissing it goodbye. Still here, still get up in the morning, still enjoy everything, but it's nothing to hold on to. It's like Uchiyama Roshi said, you open your hand of thought, because it's all thinking. Attachment is all the thought of stuff. But if we open it up, we can let it go. Not easy. Thank you.
I remember Rose pointed me to the Tommy Lin, this meditation where you somehow, and I don't even know, so the reason it's kind of difficult, for one thing, it's just that I've been just very, you know, very many, you know, heart-grabbing things lately. And I'm just, you know, I know ultimately seeking enlightenment, ultimately that just helps everyone, but I don't really hear a language about what we can actively do, you know. So much in these books lately, or in
kind of our conversations, but it kind of made me remember that, you know, when we were reading that Tibetan teacher, I can't remember what his name.
Sando Kai?
The first one I came from. No, you said Trungpa.
Trungpa.
I mean, those are more kind of active, how are we engaging, mm-hmm. I guess. And the Tonglen sort of seemed...
it's a thing to do.
It's a thing to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know what I guess I kind of just wanted to ask, do we ever talk about energy when we're in Zen? And I don't think we do.
Well,
sending energy or...
It is energy. Yeah. I mean, the whole universe is energy. That's why we're like this. And when we make our changes as we do, the changes are energetics. And when we disappear, we don't disappear. Our energy becomes another thing. It's like being a wave in the ocean. We just sink into the ocean and continue as energy. That's why they say there's no end to it. So as a little wave in a big ocean, we can't do as much as we would like to often. And in our culture, we are exposed to so many things that need help, so many things that are tragic that we can't do anything about personally. But life isn't personal. Our life isn't personal except on a very small piece of it. So whatever we do is having an effect, an energetic effect in the rest of the world. However we live our Buddha body is affecting everything. And we can't tell how it's happening. We can't tell what the effect is. I always say it's like, I feel like being a little boat, because I love little boats. And if you're going ahead in the water, the way you know how to stay on line, to go where you want to go, is to find something ahead of you and line up the bow with it. And you hold the tiller. So you have no idea where you come from. You have no idea what the wake behind you is leaving. And I think our life is like that. We really don't know what our effect is, and we don't need to know. We just need to make sure we stay with that pine tree out there. Keep the tiller and don't let it go. That's all we can do. And it's humble, it's modest, but in the confines of what we are, it's the best, really. We can do the best. And we can cry a lot. Sometimes we have to cry a lot.
Well, I also just love the message of it's not, you don't have to be so precious about it.
Yes.
Which, right what you said, I just wanted to tell everybody that there's this delicious beer at Mission Creek Brewery called Mindfulness.
I know just how you feel.
I've had a few.
Trouble is, proselytizing doesn't work. We can't go and say, oh, you've got to listen to this. This is really cool. You know, it just doesn't work. It all happens in its own time, I think, as we look at our own lives. It just came when it came. We don't know what the causes and conditions were that brought us to sit and to find this bigger way. But what a mercy.
Thank you.
Anything else? Well, he's going to be challenged. So we get to enjoy his challenges. Are there announcements?
I won't be here next week. It's Tuesday. We have to stay.
We'll miss you.
So I'll be missing you.
Okay.
I will open for you then.
Thank you.
Oh, nice.
I appreciate you opening for me 2 weeks.
Very nice.
Love execution. So I have, I think I'm going to call these the moment of Zendo. Your moment of Zendo. So last week we talked about facing the altar when we bow, and then when we chant, turning and facing each other for anybody that wasn't here, because then, as Angie said, our voices blend. And the other thing I wanted to talk about was Kinhin, the walking meditation that we do. You know, we do walking meditation before sitting, so that when people come in late or they're, you know, frazzled from work, as I often am, they can just, you know, settle down before they get on the cushion. So to do a lot of work with the breath in here, you know, following the breath. And Kinhin is the same thing, so following the breath. So we'll be talking about, Angie and I were talking about the form. So my understanding is that you want to follow your breath, and for every breath, half step. It's very hard to describe in words. Inhale, exhale, half step. Inhale, exhale, half step. Or you can half step on the inhale.
Tiny steps. Coben used to say, you should just appear on the other side of the room without being able to explain how you got there. Huh. That's very helpful. Thank you. Okay. A little sip.